one entity. Alas, if only Freud, who himself said anatomy is destiny, had had the clitoral sense to see that this powerful organ would eventually rise from the ashes of his much ballyhooed cigar. In fairness to Freud, it should be acknowledged that as he neared the end of his life, he acknowledged his incomplete understanding of female sexuality and said, "If you want to know more about femininity, you must interrogate your own experience or turn to the poets, or else wait until science can give you more profound and more coherent information." Today, our understanding and appreciation of the importance of the clitoris and the stimulation of it owes much to the dogged efforts of those impassioned individuals who bucked the conventional wisdom and did battle throughout the sexual revolution of the 1950s, 60s, and 1970s. Prominent figures such as Dr. Alfred Kinsey, Masters and Johnson, Cher Hite, Betty Dodson, and less prominent but equally important ones like Dr. Mary Jane Scherfee, who pioneered the idea that the clitoris is a powerful organ system. But knowledge is only powerful when disseminated and put into practice. Men need to take the time to learn what most women know intuitively about their bodies, how to listen to and feel them. And sex needs to be redefined as an activity that accommodates a wide variety of sensual and erotic activities, including, but by no means limited to, genital intercourse. In both philosophy and practice, any definition of sex must first and foremost include a powerful element of respect. According to journalist Paula Kamen, author of the Survey of Sexual Attitudes, Her Way, women receiving oral sex is an act most directly reflecting women's growing power in both their sexual relationships and in society. The practice depends on both women's and men's recognition and respect of this power. In The Cradle of Erotica by A. Edwards and R. E. L. Masters, we are told that during the Tang Dynasty, the Empress Wuhu ruled China. She knew that sex and power were inexorably linked, and she decreed that government officials and visiting dignitaries must pay homage to Her Imperial Highness by performing cunnilingus upon her. No joke. Old paintings depict the beautiful, powerful Empress standing and holding her ornate robe open while a high nobleman or diplomat is shown kneeling before her, applying his lips and tongue to her royal mound. Well, gone are the days of kings and queens and royal decrees, but inside many a modern woman is an Empress Wuhu, longing to be honored by her noblemen. 8. What's in a name? Let's face it, most men can more easily identify what's under the hood of a car than what's under the hood of a clitoris. This genital confusion arises because parts of the clitoral network are hidden from the naked eye. Even though the genitals of both men and women are formed from the same embryonic material and developed during gestation in an equivalent manner, the penis grows out, while much of the clitoris grows in. Interestingly, Oliver Wendell Holmes remarked that the female genitalia were simply those of the male turned inside out. But on the contrary, modern science teaches us that the male is a modified female, differentiated during the first trimester of pregnancy. So if anything, the male genitalia are a mirror image of the female's, rather than vice versa. Vagina or vulva? That is the question. The visible parts of the female genitalia are encompassed by the vulva, or what's commonly and mistakenly referred to as the vagina. Vagina tends to be the de facto word we use to describe everything down there, but the entrance to the vagina, also known as the introitus, is just one part of the vulva's impressive expanse, and certainly not the primary part when it comes to stimulation and the process of arousal. Etymologically, vagina originates from a Latin word meaning a sheath or scabbard for a sword, reinforcing its relationship to the penis and dependency upon penetration or insertion for broader meaning, which may be indicative of the reproductive process, but certainly not the pleasure process. What's in a name? According to Shakespeare, that which we call a rose, by any other name would smell as sweet. But the language of science is by no means the language of love. Cunnilingus, vulva, and vaginal introitus. Those may not be the first words that come to mind in the heat of the moment, but they're the right words in that they're scientifically accurate and properly descriptive. And knowing the right words is a powerful starting point for clearly understanding the process of sexual response and ultimately developing an erotic lexicon that is unique and true to the spirit of your individual relationship. In speaking of the vagina monologues, author and activist Eve Ensler described her thought process in committing to the word vagina in both the title and throughout the work. I say it because we haven't come up with a word that is more inclusive, that really describes the entire area and all its parts. Pussy is probably a better word, but it has so much baggage connected with it. And besides, I don't think most of us have a clear idea of what we're talking about when we say pussy. Vulva is a good word. It speaks more specifically, but I don't think most of us are clear what the vulva includes. Ms. Ensler is right. The term vulva is much more specific and inclusive, especially when describing the visible parts of the clitoris. Although the vagina plays an extremely active role in the reproductive process, it takes a back seat to the clitoris in the production of pleasure. Employing vagina as a catch-all phrase for describing a woman's genitalia actually promotes an inaccurate understanding of female anatomy, perhaps even more so than the more generic down there. So vulva it is, in the interest of accuracy, as well as in the hope of promoting greater familiarity with the term. The words you choose to use in your bedroom are your own business. Supplying you with accurate knowledge is this book's business. 9. Now you see it. Female Sexual Anatomy, Part 1. The Vulva and External Parts of the Clitoris. Starting with the visible parts of the clitoral network, let's take a closer look at what's really down there. The mons pubis. We begin our journey north at the mons pubis, also known as the mons veneris, mountain of Venus, named after the Roman goddess of love. The mons pubis is a thick pad of fatty tissue, covered in pubic hair, which is sometimes called the love mound, because it forms a soft mound over the pubic bone. The labia majora. Heading south from the mons pubis, we next encounter the starting point of the labia majora, major lips. The outer side of the labia majora, also known as the outer lips, are rich with pubic hair, whereas the inner sides are smooth, lined with oil and sweat glands. Beneath the skin of the outer lips is a network of erectile tissue that engorges with blood during arousal. The outer lips are analogous to the male scrotum, and both were formed from the same embryonic tissue. Although sensitive to touch, the outer lips are not nearly as sensitive as the labia minora, small lips, or other parts of the clitoral network, such as the head and shaft. The front commissure. The outer lips mark an area where the visible parts of the clitoris begin. This highly sensitive area, just above the clitoral head, is called the front commissure, and it's from this point that the clitoral shaft, an unseen but instrumental part of the clitoris, protrudes. The labia minora. Enfolded within the labia majora are the labia minora, little lips. Although many insist that it's more apt to refer to both sets of lips respectively as outer and inner, rather than big and little, since the inner lips sometimes protrude out and beyond the outer lips. Interestingly, the inner lips are also archaically known as nymphae, named after the nymphs of ancient Greece who were famous for their irrepressible libidos and are the source of the term nymphomania. The inner lips enfold and surround the clitoral glands, the head, the urethral opening, and the introitus, entrance, to the vagina. Like the inner side of the labia majora, these smaller inner lips have no hair, but are layered with oil glands that look and feel like tiny bumps. Dense with nerves, the inner lips are extremely sensitive and play an important role in the process of arousal. The inner lips are remarkably diverse in size and appearance. From woman to woman, and often on the same woman, no two lips are the same. Some lips are narrow, others wide, Some curl inward, others flare outward. Sometimes the texture is glossy and smooth, sometimes wrinkled and bumpy. During the process of arousal, the inner lips change color, from light pink to darker hues, and swell and puff in size as they engorge with blood. The hood. The outer edges of the inner lips meet just above the sensitive clitoral head to form the well-known protective hood, which is analogous to the foreskin of the penis, also known as the prepuce. The friction created when the clitoral hood rubs against the head is a powerful source of stimulation and pleasure. The hood also protects the head from overstimulation. Just prior to the release of orgasm, it's into the folds of the hood that the head seeks refuge. The frenulum. Below the head, the inner edges of the labia minora meet to form the frenulum, a small expanse of soft, sensitive skin, also known as the bridle. Like the inner lips, this area is rich in nerve fibers and is extremely sensitive to the touch. The fourchette. The bottom edges of the lips meet beneath the vaginal entrance in an area known as the fourchette, or little fork. Just as the front commissure marks the top part of the visible clitoris, the fourchette marks the bottom. The clitoral glands, the head. Protected by the hood of the inner lips, the head is the crown jewel that rests atop the unseen shaft and crura, the legs. With approximately 8,000 nerve endings, twice as many as the head of the penis, and more than any other part of the human body, the head is the visible part of a woman's clitoris that often gets referred to as the love button. It's not a bad term, just remember that it only applies to one part of the clitoris, the head. One of the biggest mistakes a lover can make is to underestimate the sensitivity of the clitoral head. In fact, at the peak of sexual arousal, the head becomes so sensitive that with a little help from the suspensory ligament, an unseen part of the clitoris, it retracts beneath its hood and is often hidden at the moment of climax. Some heads are large, others are small. Size varies greatly, just as it does with the male penis. But regardless of size and shape, all contain the same number of nerve endings, so clitoral dimensions have no impact on a woman's sensitivity. There's quite a bit of contention over the etymology of the word clitoris. Some believe it stems from the Greek clitoris, meaning little hill or slope. Others say it comes from the Greek verb clitoriazon, meaning to touch or titillate lasciviously, to be inclined to pleasure. And still others claim that the Greek word clitoris originally meant divine and goddess-like. In some sense, all these meanings are true. Perineum. The perineum is the small expanse of skin just above the anus and beneath the vaginal entrance, sometimes referred to casually as the taint, because it taint one or the other. Beneath the skin of the perineum is a network of blood vessels and tissue, which fill with blood during arousal and become intensely sensitive. Dr. Kinsey observed during his research that the perineum is highly sensitive to touch, and tactile stimulation of the area may provide considerable erotic arousal. When making your travel plans of the clitoral network, make sure to include this southern hotspot. 10. Now you see it, now you don't. Female Sexual Anatomy, Part 2. The internal parts of the clitoris. When it comes to the female genitalia and the hidden parts of the clitoris, seeing is only the first part of believing. You need to rely on all of your senses, especially touch. In their book, A New View of a Woman's Body, the Feminist Center for Health identified 18 parts in the clitoral network, many of which are unseen but are nonetheless felt or contribute to the experience of feeling. Let's review the internal parts of the clitoris. The clitoral body. Attached to the head and running just beneath the surface of the skin, the clitoral shaft can easily be felt, especially when aroused and filled with blood. A soft little pipe, the shaft is composed of spongy erectile tissue that is extremely receptive to sensation. The shaft extends north from the head towards the mons pubis for about 3/4 of an inch before forking and dividing like a wishbone into two thin crura, or legs, that flare downward along the path of the inner lips and surround twin bulbs of erectile tissue, known as the clitoral bulbs. If you've ever noticed that the clitoral head seems to retract and disappear under its protective hood during peak arousal, that's because the suspensory ligament attached to the head at one end and the ovaries at the other is being stretched, causing the head to retract. Additionally, the clitoris has layers of muscle, usually referred to as vaginal muscles or pelvic floor muscles. There is the oval-shaped bulbocavernous muscle that rests between the inner lips and the bulbs of the clitoris. This muscle is interwoven with muscle that encircles the anus and is part of the reason that anal stimulation is often a turn-on and hence part of the clitoral network. Underneath it all is a broad, flat layer of muscle called pubococcygeus, or PC muscle. The PC muscle is also known as the Kegel muscle, named after Dr. Arnold Kegel, who observed that the PC muscle contracts during orgasm. Kegel subsequently developed a series of exercises designed to strengthen the pelvic muscles and heighten pleasure for both partners, hence the birth of Kegels. In both men and women, the PC muscle is easily identified as the one that allows us to stop the flow of urine. 11. Avoid G-spotty logic. Let's talk about spot removal. G-spot removal, that is, starting at the urethral opening and running about 2 inches deep to the bladder is the urethra, which first and foremost enables the removal of urine. Surrounding the urethra is a ring of spongy erectile tissue known as corpus spongiosum, which fills with blood during arousal and protects the urethra from the friction of penetration. This area of spongy tissue is also known as the much ballyhooed G-spot, named in 1944 after Dr. Ernest Graffenberg, who described a zone of erogenous feeling located along the suburethral surface of the anterior vaginal wall. In layman's terms, Dr. Kinsey observed, most of those women who did notice some response had the sensitivity confined to a certain point, in most cases the upper wall of the vagina, just inside the vaginal entrance. For all its hype, the G-spot, as cited earlier, may simply be nothing more than the roots of the clitoris crisscrossing the urethral sponge. While sensitive to stimulation, but without nearly as many nerve endings as the clitoral head, the G-spot generally responds to a more persistent, massaging pressure. It's not uncommon for a woman to feel a fleeting urge to urinate when this area is stimulated. A whole lot of fuss has been made over the difference between a clitoral orgasm and a G-spot orgasm, with many claiming that the latter is responsible for the production of the fuller vaginal orgasm. This hubbub reached its apex with the publication in 1982 of The G-Spot by Alice Kahn Lottis, Beverly Whipple, and Dr. John Perry. In retrospect, it's possible to argue that all their book ultimately accomplished was to reintroduce a spruced-up, hyped-up theory of the vaginal orgasm into the mainstream with the added bonus of female ejaculation. Of course it was a cultural sensation. The notion of a G-spot dovetailed seamlessly into the intercourse discourse and gave penetration a new, invigorated raison d'etre. Is that revolutionary or just plain reactionary? As we discussed earlier, the whole idea of a mature vaginal orgasm versus an immature clitoral one was a bogus construct to begin with, promulgated by Freud, perpetuated by his followers, and reinvented and sensationalized in the form of the G-spot. And although the urethral sponge is indeed attached to the vaginal ceiling, it is nevertheless considered an integral part of the clitoral network and not a separate part of the vagina that produces pleasure. A G-spot orgasm, like all female orgasms, is a clitoral orgasm. It's part of the same pleasure network. As such, when we address the techniques in Part 2, this book will make a somewhat radical break from the tradition of erotological literature by referring to the area that is generally known as the G-spot as the clitoral cluster, a name that more accurately and simply expresses its anatomical power and role in the process of female sexual response. 12. When raindrops keep falling on your head, female ejaculation. The G-spot is also thought to be the source of female ejaculation, another matter of controversy. Does a woman actually ejaculate? The answer is yes, but not in the same sense as the explosive male orgasm, and not nearly as often as the ejaculation evangelists would have us believe. In general, female ejaculation appears to be the exception rather than the rule. Today, a whole industry has emerged around the concept, pitching a vast array of books, tapes, videos, and seminars that urge women to discover and master their ejaculatory potential. But amid all the snake oil, it's worth keeping in mind that the orgasm reflex is part of the autonomic nervous system. It's an involuntary response outside of the control of the mind. The momentary out-of-body sense of timelessness that we experience when we've reached the point of no return is intrinsic to the release of sexual tension and part and parcel of the joy of sexual ecstasy. It shouldn't be muddled up with mind control exercises that may in the end enable a woman to produce a wee bit of fluid, but do not qualitatively enhance the experience of orgasm and indeed may ultimately detract from it. Where does female ejaculate come from? Depends on what type of emission you're talking about. The type of fluid that sometimes gets released as part of the natural involuntary orgasmic reflex appears to originate in the area of spongy tissue that surrounds the urethra and encompasses tiny paraurethral glands. Two of the largest of these glands are called Skene's glands and appear near the urethral opening. Some studies have argued that the fluid produced by these glands is actually urine. Upon analysis, however, it's been concluded that these glands, in fact, produce a clear alkaline fluid that is much closer in composition to male prostatic fluid and gives rise to the even more controversial notion of the existence of a female prostate. In fact, until 1880, these paraurethral glands were simply called prostates. In short, female ejaculate of this sort is not urine. However, the fluid that is reputed to gush when consciously impelled by the bearing down of the pelvic muscles may very well be coming from the bladder and thereby contain urine. Women who train themselves to consciously ejaculate also appear to produce more fluid than women who emit fluid involuntarily, lending further credence to the idea that urine may be contributing to the overall volume of ejaculate. What's interesting as well is that interviews with women who are able to voluntarily ejaculate reveal that the process is independent of sexual arousal and does not necessarily heighten the pleasure of orgasm, whereas women who involuntarily ejaculate are unable to parse the experience of orgasm and ejaculation and often don't even know they've ejaculated. All in all, it does not appear that ejaculation, voluntary or involuntary, does much to enhance the pleasure of orgasm. To that end, a woman's time would be better spent on Kegel exercises and the strengthening of the pelvic floor muscles, an exercise known to increase the quality of orgasmic contractions. 13. How wet is wet? The vagina is vital to the reproductive process. As a birth canal, as a receptacle for sperm, and a vehicle for the release of menstrual blood, but not in the production of pleasure. In a non-aroused state, the vagina is a compressed tube, about 3 to 4 inches long, composed of muscle and lined with mucous membranes not dissimilar to the lining of the mouth. During arousal, a woman's vagina widens and opens in order to accommodate the penis, a few inches in both depth and width, creating what Masters and Johnson referred to as the ballooning effect. Meanwhile, the outer third of the vagina begins to narrow and tighten as the clitoral structures that are located there fill with blood. This compression creates a clitoral cuff that actually helps stimulate a man to orgasm through the application of pressure and friction against the penis. A woman's vagina usually begins to lubricate shortly after stimulation. What looks like beads of sweat form all over the vaginal walls. This is sometimes called vaginal sweating. Just below the vaginal opening are the ducts that connect the vulvovaginal glands, which secrete a few drops of thick fluid that contribute, along with the sweating of the vagina, to the lubrication of the vaginal opening. As we will discuss in the section on foreplay, lubrication is a big part of the arousal process, but is by no means an unequivocal indicator that a woman's been amply stimulated. She may be lubricated, but not necessarily aroused. These secretions are part of the vagina's natural way of keeping it free of bacteria that don't belong there. Conversely, a woman may be highly aroused, yet not necessarily well lubricated. In short, a woman's ability to lubricate can be impacted by a variety of factors, her estrogen levels, diet, and stress, to name a few. And while lubrication is connected to the process of arousal and plays an important role in subsequent sexual activity, assessing her readiness depends on a variety of factors and is ultimately more art than science. Now that we've met the various parts of the clitoral network, both visible and hidden, let's take a closer look at how they interact and come together in the process of sexual response. Again, we take our cue from Strunk and White. Before beginning to compose something, gauge the nature and extent of the enterprise and work from a suitable design. You cannot plunge in blindly, lest you miss the forest for the trees and there be no end to your labors. 14. Aristotle and the Poetics of Arousal. Our principles now being established, let us now discuss the proper structure of the plot, since this is the first and most important thing. 2,500 years ago, the Greek philosopher Aristotle delineated in his timeless work Poetics the fundamental elements of Greek tragedy and much of what we understand today to be the essence of narrative storytelling. Like a great work of dramatic literature, there's a structure to the process of arousal, a narrative that encompasses a beginning, middle, and end, with each element taking its natural place in the overall sequence of events. The parts of the clitoral network that we met in the preceding chapters are like actors in a drama that interact and make their entrances and exits according to the cues of the larger script. Aristotle emphasized the importance of the plot, the call to action that sets into motion a series of events that unfold over time in a unified, organic manner, the driving force that defies chaos and governs the arrangement of the scenes, the structure that confers order and reason upon the various parts and weaves them together into an organized whole, that which has a beginning, middle, and end. Most important of all is the structure of the incidents, said Aristotle. If any one of them is displaced or removed, the whole will be disjointed and disturbed. In the drama of arousal, body and mind are called to action. Sexual tension develops and builds to a peak, climax occurs, and then relaxation ensues. Masters and Johnson called this sequence the sexual response cycle, while sex researchers Beverly Whipple and Barry Komisarek called it the orgasmic process. Each described the unfolding of an almost procedural series of events, with each successive step dependent on the satisfactory completion of the one that comes before it. Masters and Johnson broke down the process of sexual response into four stages: excitement, plateau, orgasm, and resolution. With the application of steady, rhythmic stimulation, each phase builds upon the last in the creation and release of sexual tension. In part two, the section of this book dedicated to specific techniques, we will refer to the journey through sexual response as the play process, one that encompasses three distinct stages: foreplay, coreplay, and moreplay. With that in mind, let's move on to a synopsis of sexual response. 15. A synopsis of female sexual response. Act 1. Foreplay. The call to action. In Act 1, foreplay galvanizes the mind and body towards sexual response. Dozens of chemicals and hormones are released into the bloodstream, causing a woman to become emotionally stoned, according to Dr. Teresa Crenshaw, author of The Alchemy of Love and Lust. The flow of blood is redirected toward the pelvic area. Nerve fibers in the genital area become excited, and erectile tissue begins to engorge. Across the body, the skin becomes extra sensitive to touch. The breasts swell in size, and stimulation of the nipples initiates the production of oxytocin, a hormone that creates pleasurable sensations throughout the genital area. As blood vessels force fluid through the walls of the vagina, the vulvovaginal glands produce a small amount of thick fluid that acts as a lubricant. The clitoral head emerges from its hood. Act 2. Coreplay, tension, and release. Muscle tension builds throughout the body. Respiration increases, blood pressure goes up, and the heart beats faster. The entrance to the vagina narrows while its inner depths widen and increase at least 2 inches in length. The clitoral body, the shaft, legs, and bulb, stiffens, stretches, and elongates. The spongy tissue of the clitoral cluster swells, and its ridges can be clearly felt protruding from the vaginal ceiling. The suspensory ligament tightens and causes the highly sensitized clitoral head to retract beneath its hood, where it will remain until orgasm. The round ligament, positioned between the uterus and the inner lips, tugs on both ends, involving the uterus in the process of sexual response and climax. As coreplay continues, the skin flushes, breathing deepens. The heart rate soars, everything tightens in a final clench. Her inner labia change color, darkening with the engorgement of blood. Finally, all the muscular tension that has been building explodes in orgasm, a series of quick, rhythmic contractions. The vaginal walls and the pelvic floor muscles contract rhythmically in approximately 0.8-second intervals. The sphincter muscles in the rectum also contract spasmodically in sync with genital contractions. In addition, the uterus contracts because of an influx of oxytocin. These contractions produce waves of pleasure, and with some women, the orgasm is accompanied by the ejaculation of a small amount of clear alkaline fluid. The number of orgasmic contractions varies, anywhere from 3 to 15 on average, although Masters and Johnson observed a woman who experienced a 43-second orgasm consisting of more than 25 successive contractions. Additionally, it's been observed that pregnant women sometimes experience prolonged orgasms because of the persistent engorgement of their genitals. While the orgasm originates from the genital area, it is often experienced and felt throughout the body. Every woman's orgasm is different and highly individualized. Sex researchers often refer to this sense of uniqueness as orgasmic fingerprinting. There's a wonderful passage in Norman Rush's novel Mortals, in which the central character recounts his wife's description of an orgasm, or rather, in her words, what it feels like when you come really hard. She says, "Well, part of what it feels like is this, that you're just a drop of oil on a white tablecloth, just a tiny still drop of oil, and then in a flash, you're expanding outward in every direction, evenly, turning into a stain, a little drop expanding into a bright stain that covers the universe, the process of that, the expanding, that's part of it." Act 3. More play. The return to balance. After orgasm is the resolution phase, a return to calm and the pre-aroused state. Men and women differ strikingly in this phase, with the former losing their erections quickly and entering into what's known as a refractory period, an interval of time that needs to pass before he can get an erection again. With women, it takes longer for the genitals to return to their normal state, at least 5 to 10 minutes. Women tend not to get sleepy, their genitals don't become hypersensitive except the clitoral head, and they don't experience a refractory period. With a little stimulation, they're ready to begin the process all over again. The difference between how men and women experience the resolution phase is what I call the snuggle gap. Women want much more interaction. Men want to roll over and go to sleep. While much literature has been devoted to the insensitivity of men and the neediness of women in this respect, it's far more effective to understand that the snuggle gap is largely the result of biology. Men crash quickly after sex. Women come down slowly. So don't overanalyze or get angry and pick a fight. Instead, respect each other's differences and compromise. Fall asleep while holding her in your arms. There we have it in a nutshell, the narrative process of arousal. Even though the structure is universal, every story is unique. How it plays out has everything to do with the characters involved. Sometimes the story might unfold in a matter of minutes. Other times it may take hours. In the Poetics, the only rule is that the action must occur in a manner uninterrupted and take place within a 24-hour period. As Aristotle observed, a beautiful object, whether it be a living organism or any whole composed of parts, must not only have an orderly arrangement of parts, but must also be of a certain magnitude, for beauty depends on magnitude and order. 16. Scent and sensibility. Cunnilingus, perhaps more than any other expression of sexuality, falls prey to the yes-but syndrome. Yes, both men and women appear on balance to enjoy giving and receiving respectively, but not, it seems, without reservation. As noted in the Height report on male sexuality, almost half of all men who said they enjoyed cunnilingus were nonetheless preoccupied with issues of cleanliness and hygiene. And closely associated with those concerns were comments that women's genitals smelled bad. A smaller percentage of men did not share these concerns, and an even smaller group of aficionados claimed to love the taste and smell. But such enthusiasts are in the minority. Rare is the man who can completely show steadfast ardor in savoring a woman's cassoulet, the French word for perfume box, and used colloquially to describe a woman's unique scent, the sum total of her effluvia, her aromatic signature, and exalt, free of prejudice, in the powerful rush of pheromones. But what about all the women who, whether bombarded with media messages stressing the importance of feminine freshness, or worn down by fish jokes, or simply unacquainted with their own genitalia, share these preoccupations and approach their bodies with fear, shame, or even self-loathing? And cunnilingus, with its elimination of distance and its unavoidable intimacy, is often a lightning rod for unleashing anxiety. All this fuss and hullabaloo over hygiene, and yet in reality, a woman's genitals are a self-cleaning system, more sanitary than many other parts of the body, including the mouth. One of the reasons a woman is often lubricated, even when she's not aroused, is that these secretions are part of the vagina's natural way of keeping it bacteria-free. As science writer Natalie Angier has written, the vagina is its own ecosystem, a land of unsung symbiosis and tart vigor. Sure, the traditional concept of a vagina is, it's a swamp down there. But tidal pool would be more accurate, aqueous, stable, yet in perpetual flux. At the core of this ecosystem is a sophisticated process of symbiosis, one in which healthy bacteria protect and ward off the unhealthy. It's been said that a woman's genitals are as clean and fresh as a carton of yogurt, and this comparison is often made because the kind of bacteria found in yogurt, lactobacilli, are also found in a woman's vaginal secretions. In fact, if symbiosis is compromised and unhealthy, anaerobic bacteria gain an advantage, and eating yogurt can often help to stave off infection and restore balance. If there is a bad smell in the genital area, the first thing worth paying attention to is personal hygiene. Like men, women sweat down there, and more often than not, showering or bathing, or even engaging in what the French refer to as a tart wash, a quick freshening of the underarms and genital area, can usually help to rid oneself of any unwanted odors. Later in part 2, we'll discuss how to eroticize these activities and incorporate hygiene into the excitement. However, if personal hygiene has been attended to and an off-putting odor still persists, it's probably time to go to the doctor. She could be suffering from an infection, bacterial vaginosis, in which a lack of lactobacilli creates an imbalance and allows anaerobic bacteria to accumulate. This, according to Natalie Angier, is where the comparison to fish often comes into play. as these microbes produce trimethylene, the same substance that gives day-old fish its odor. Gertrude Stein, a cunnilinguist in her own right, may have been mistaken. A rose is a rose is not always a rose. Some women are born with imbalances and might have a predisposition towards vaginosis and a stronger odor. In addition to eating yogurt, there are also antibiotic treatments that can help restore balance. Every woman smells and tastes different. Some are sweeter than others. Some are a bit more pungent. Still others are more neutral and nondescript. Sometimes the differences are subtle. Other times they are stark. Nor will the same woman always consistently smell or taste the same. Lots of factors can affect smell and taste, including diet, vitamin deficiencies, medication, her cycle. Some women produce vaginal secretions that contain compounds called aliphatic acid chains and may cause her scent to vary with the phase of her menstrual cycle. Infection, hydration, alcohol, drugs, tobacco. Unprotected sex can often affect a woman's smell in that sperm is highly alkaline and raises the pH level of the vaginal ecosystem. When it comes to taste and smell and overall concerns about hygiene, watch out for anxiety brought about by excessive pheromone activity. It's contagious, if not downright viral. Know that a healthy vagina is a clean vagina. Don't let your anxiety trigger a vicious cycle. Instead, transform that nervous energy into enthusiasm. Enjoy and savor her unique cassoulet. Now there's an idea worth raising a glass to and toasting. In fact, says Natalie Angier, the idea of pairing wine and women isn't a bad one, as the acidity of the vagina in health is just about that of a glass of red wine. This is the vagina that sings. This is the vagina with a bouquet. Cheers. 17. We've come a long way. Oral sex in America, especially cunnilingus, has come a long, long way. Back in the 1920s, oral sex, also known as the genital kiss, was thought to be an activity best left to the marital bed and was largely deemed a special gesture, a bonus expression of intimacy, but not necessarily a regular part of a couple's sexual practices. It was definitely not a casual activity and was usually thought to be something that occurred after a couple was already having intercourse in a committed relationship. So much for the roaring 20s sounds more like the boring 20s. Attitudes began to ease a bit in the 1940s and 1950s, with studies showing that oral sex was becoming more prevalent and better known as a technique that was especially satisfying for women. Even so, in a 1953 Kinsey report, only 3% of younger women who were still virgins reported ever receiving cunnilingus. The rate was substantially higher among married women. During the sexual revolution of the 1960s and 1970s, oral sex evolved into an acceptable practice for all couples, whether or not they were married. It became particularly popular on college campuses, and maybe that's why to this day, according to the authors of Sex in America, a definitive survey, twice as many women who went to college have given or received oral sex as compared to those who did not finish high school, and twice as many of those better educated women had or received oral sex the last time they had sex. Whereas men's rates of receiving oral sex peaked and leveled out in the 1960s, it appears that women spent the remainder of the 20th century catching up, with rates steadily rising year after year. Today, cunnilingus is considered to be an important part of the arousal process, with enlightened and sexually confident women insisting on quid pro quo, giving according to how they receive. If there has been any basic change in the script for sex between men and women, it is the increase in the incidence and frequency of fellatio and cunnilingus. From the conservative to the liberal, women of all stripes enjoy cunnilingus. In examining contemporary sexual mores, the authors of the 1994 Sex in America survey, based on the National Health and Social Life Survey, grouped their participants into three different categories: traditional, relational, and recreational. The traditionalists were those people who maintained that their religious beliefs always guided their sexual behavior and believed that homosexuality was wrong. They also believed in restrictions on abortion and did not condone premarital sex, teenage sex, or extramarital sex. Relationalists believed that sex did not have to be reserved for marriage, but that it should be part of a loving relationship. They condoned premarital sex, but did not condone infidelity or sex without love. Finally, the recreationalists did not believe that sex need have anything to do with love, and they also opposed laws that prohibited the sale of pornography. Based on these categories, 83.6% of those women with a recreational attitude had experienced oral sex in the last year, followed by 73.9% of women who were relational and 55.9% of women with traditional views. If we look at the numbers in terms of age, 74.7% of women from 18 to 24 received oral sex, compared with 73.7% of women aged 30 to 34. Women and men aged 18 to 39 were most likely to include cunnilingus in their sex lives, with 22.3% to 24.2% reporting having done it during their last sexual experience. Conversely, for women aged 40 to 44, the rate fell to 12.6%. So, it would appear that the younger you are, the more likely you are to have experienced cunnilingus, and the more likely you are to have experienced it earlier in your lifetime. As Nancy Friday wrote of cunnilingus in her 1991 book, Women on Top, women have finally come of age. Having discovered it, they can't get enough. Nor, it seems, can men for that matter. Happily, this adoption of cunnilingus as a regular part of sexual activity is not just a function of young women becoming more confident and assertive in their demand for a level playing field, but is also indicative of a shift in male attitudes. As men become more sensitive to the importance of the female orgasm and recognize the unreliability of genital intercourse in achieving one, they increasingly incorporate cunnilingus into their repertoire of sexual techniques. As Glamour magazine noted in their 1997 feature, Good News About Your Sex Life, a majority of men say they enjoy performing oral sex, and numerous studies report that men describe giving oral sex as very appealing. If you think it all sounds too good to be true, you're right. 18. You've come a long way, but proceed with caution. If you give or receive cunnilingus casually in an unsafe, unprotected environment, you are willfully placing yourself in a high-risk category for the transmission and or contraction of an STD, including AIDS, gonorrhea, syphilis, genital herpes, chlamydia, genital warts, and hepatitis. Men also need to worry about non-gonococcal urethritis, whereas women should be more than a little concerned about pelvic inflammatory disease. Of these diseases, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, non-gonococcal urethritis, and pelvic inflammatory disease are caused by the transmission of bacteria and can be cured with antibiotics if caught early enough. The rest are viral and without cure, although in some cases the symptoms are treatable. These STDs are highly contagious and can be transmitted from vulva to mouth and vice versa. These days, AIDS seems to garner most of the attention, but according to the Sex in America survey, the people who are most likely to be infected with sexually transmitted diseases are not the same group who are at risk for AIDS. They are a much larger group. That's not to say there isn't any risk of contracting or transmitting AIDS via cunnilingus. Vaginal secretions of women who are HIV positive have been found to contain small amounts of HIV, with the amounts rising when she is menstruating, and HIV positive men can also transmit the virus via cuts in the mouth. But unprotected cunnilingus places you at greater risk for a far wider array of STDs. Of those participants surveyed in the Sex in America survey, 1 in 6 said they had had an STD at some point in their lives, with a significant percentage reporting having had one in the last year. Says the survey, to put the numbers in perspective, nearly as many said they had had a venereal disease in the last year as said they had been pregnant in the last year. Based on the numbers, it appears that women are more likely to have had at least one STD at some point in their lives. They were twice as likely as men to have had genital warts and more than twice as likely to be infected with genital herpes. Overall, 18% of women and 16% of men have contracted one of the 9 sexually transmitted diseases covered in the survey, with chlamydia and genital warts taking the top spots, displacing the formerly more common gonorrhea. The authors of Sex in America emphasize that the higher rate of STDs in women is by no means an indication of higher promiscuity, but rather that it is at least twice as easy for a man to infect a woman with virtually any sexually transmitted disease, including AIDS, than it is for a woman to infect a man. Fortunately, it's possible to pinpoint the attitudes and practices that increase the likelihood of being at risk for an STD versus those that don't. Although we find that large numbers of Americans have had a sexually transmitted disease at least once in their lives, there is nothing random about where the diseases strike. The people who are most likely to be infected share one key characteristic. They have many sex partners. If a man has 2 to 4 sexual partners in his lifetime, his chances of contracting an STD are about 3%. As the number of partners increases, so does the risk. With more than 20 partners, his risk is about 28%. The same rough pattern is true of women, with the spectrum of percentages increasing from 5 to 35%. It should therefore come as no surprise that the more partners a person has had, the more likely that he or she is engaged with those partners outside of a monogamous relationship, and that his or her partner falls into a similar pattern of promiscuity, thereby greatly increasing the risk of having come into contact with an STD. As it turns out, promiscuity triggers a domino effect of risky behaviors. According to the Sex in America survey, the more partners an individual has, the more likely he or she is to have sex with people who themselves have many partners, the more likely he or she is to have sex with virtual strangers, the more likely he or she is to have been under the influence of drugs or alcohol during some sexual encounters, and while it is more likely that a condom was used, the rate of increased use of a condom does not seem great enough to offset the higher risks of infection. Now you know the facts. 19. So eat right. Cunnilingus may be a casual activity, but that doesn't mean you should treat it casually. Make sure that it's part of your safe sex routine. If you're engaging a new partner, communicate openly and candidly. Be prepared to discuss your current sex partner's sexual history, risky behaviors, STD status, recent activities, and your approach to protection. Be aware that some STDs are asymptomatic and may flourish undetected. So if you find yourself caught up in the heat of the moment, think before engaging in unprotected cunnilingus. Regardless of the reward, even the smallest act is not without risk. If you're uncertain or nervous, don't take the risk. It's not worth it. And if you don't want to avoid oral sex together, then at least take precautions through the use of barriers such as dental dams, a thin strip of latex that is placed over the vulva as you apply cunnilingus, latex gloves, or finger cots, individual plastic sheaths that workers in restaurants use to protect themselves from cuts. All of these safe sex accessories can typically be found in drugstores and can also be ordered from specialty stores such as Good Vibrations or the Blowfish catalog. In a pinch, even a sheet of saran wrap will do. Just make sure you're using the non-microwavable kind, as the microwavable sort isn't impervious to bacteria. If all this talk sounds like a bummer, there is a silver lining. You can definitely have oral sex that is hot and safe. Later, we will specifically discuss techniques and routines that incorporate safe sex equipment into the process and do not diminish it. The first step is to know what you need in terms of protection and then know how to use it. During sexual activity, a condom is usually not far from reach and may typically be introduced by either partner. While condoms are generally accepted and prevalent in their use, the same cannot be said of dental dams and the accessories that make for a safe session of cunnilingus. Whereas a request to use a condom is SOP, standard operating procedure, and these days doesn't make one thing twice, the introduction of a dental dam is often attention-grabbing and may be perceived as signaling the possibility of risk as opposed to just plain it safe. Perhaps this is because condoms serve the double function of preventing both unwanted pregnancy and unwanted STDs, whereas dental dams only prevent the latter. In short, condoms often embody positive attributes, attentiveness, and concern for safety, whereas a dental dam may evoke the negative perception of risk. Rare is the guy who's been carrying a dental dam around in his wallet for years, waiting for the opportunity to put it into use, and equally rare is the woman who's going to insist he use one. But for all our talk of precaution and protection, there is no substitute for the unfettered merging of our bodies. Like the linking together of two power cables to create a single flow of electricity, your tongue against her vulva is the conjoining of thousands of nerve endings, the firing of neurons, the buzzing of receptors, the ultimate melding of body and soul in a pulse-pounding current. Such joys are ultimately experienced in a trusting, committed relationship. As Sally Tisdale wrote, "In the depth of sexual passion, the skin of the other has the quality of treasure. The mundane secretions our bodies make are honey, mana, light. To be cut off from each other's fluid is a terrible thing. Our fluids are meant to mingle. We long for this mingling that is both so outrageous and pure." When approaching safe sex, keep in mind what Dr. Comfort had to say in The New Joy of Sex. There is no occasion for panic or for losing out on the joy of sex. Simply informed caution. 20. The Cunnilinguist Manifesto. From each according to their abilities, to each according to their needs. The Communist Manifesto. To her according to your abilities, from you according to her needs. The Cunnilinguist Manifesto. There's nothing like strong words to rouse the hearts and minds of men. As we move forward into part two and focus on specific oral techniques for success, think of part one as a manifesto, a call to action that urges us first and foremost to respect the female process of arousal, postpone gratification in the pursuit of mutual pleasure, know and appreciate the clitoris in all its manifold aspects, stimulate the clitoris appropriately through the entire process of sexual response, dispense with the conventional wisdom that exalts genital penetration as the apogee of sexual pleasure. Purge yourself of stereotypes, cliches, and prejudices. Be patient, respectful, sensitive, and tender. Take an approach that is pleasure-oriented, not goal-oriented. Approach each act as a unique process of giving and receiving, knowing and learning. Give of yourself seriously, generously, and wholeheartedly, even if your relationship is casual and impermanent. Easier said than done. Even Karl Marx recognized that in order for words to become actions, the proper preconditions for success must be firmly in place. In the cunnilinguist revolution, we cannot underestimate the insidious forces of fear, shame, and ignorance. A woman may be deeply conflicted when it comes to receiving cunnilingus, and the experience may be fraught with anxiety. Who knows for sure what emotional baggage she may carry? Take nothing for granted. There's an utter nakedness to cunnilingus, a vulnerability that we must respect and honor. She is exposing herself to be seen, smelled, tasted, and observed firsthand. She is permitting the exploration of a part of her body that she herself may find unfamiliar and mysterious. She may think her vulva is ugly, unkempt, unpredictable in its secretions, odoriferous and strange. She may insist on making love in the dark, literally and figuratively. As cunnilinguists, we need to be committed, steadfast, and confident in our resolve. If she senses that we're the least bit ambivalent, insincere, or impatient, then our efforts will be for naught. Only by inspiring trust will you lull her into a deeper, more instinctive zone of the self, a place where she can shed all inhibition and surrender herself to the soft, warm wetness of your tongue.